Okay, an addendum to the announcements. I think we figured out what I was missing. It was a meal. On the last day of Unleavened Bread, there's a catered lunch that's available between services, and we're using a new facility. Well, it's not new, but it's new to us. We haven't used it, except for the ladies' meeting last fall. The price is $13.25, and there's a sign-up list for that, as well as the donation details for helping to offset the cost of the Night to Be Much Remembered meal at the restaurant with a French name. Anyway, please take note of those and sign them if you want that. Have the luncheon there at the Foltz Community Center in East Canton, then be sure to sign that list and get your check off to the Coonses. All right. We had a cousin. Well, I didn't have a cousin. My dad had a cousin, so he was my second cousin. His name was Bill. And one summer, he showed up in late June or July. I forget exactly. It was right in that time frame. And he had a farm in Wyoming. We had a farm, my father and uncle did, in South Dakota, the one near the Black Hills. And Bill showed up in the middle of the day. He could drive there. It was a couple hundred miles. He could have made it in part of a day. But he didn't seem too anxious to get back to the farm, which seemed unusual. He was a workhorse and a go-getter type and very funny. And we wanted to know why he was up here when he normally would have chores to do. He said, "I don't have any chores to do." "What, no, you don't have anything, crops to irrigate or anything?" "Nope, don't need to." "Well, why?" "Well, we got hailed out." And then we felt really bad because we got hailed out too. Not that day, but not that year, but a couple years later. We knew what hail did to the crops. And then he started describing what had happened. And it was a whole series of events. And every time he got done with one, and we kind of looked down, he says, "Oh, but if you think that was bad, you should have seen what happened next." And I'll tell you what finally happened next, and that was why he was with us when we get to the appropriate spot in the sermon. "If you think that was bad, you should have seen what happened next." I think the Egyptians must have felt like that. Because when God sent the 10 plagues, you imagine them telling their relatives or some friends in the Sudan or over in Mauritius, down the coast of the Mediterranean, "If you think that was bad, you should have seen what happened next." But when you stop to think about the 10 plagues of Egypt, sometimes we cite them, go through them, and we try to draw lessons from them, and well, we should. They lead directly to Passover, and all of those things are there for our instruction. But let's ask a question today as the title: why the 10 plagues of Egypt? What was the purpose? Why did God send 10 plagues against Egypt? Now, obviously, part of it is to make them let his people go, so the Israelites could leave Egypt and leave slavery and go and have their own land. But God could have done one of those, and they call it in the Star Wars movies, those Jedi tricks, where the power of suggestion and the weak-minded Egyptians would say, "Oh, sure, go ahead. We don't need you anymore. We'll finish this treasure city ourselves." But he didn't. God had a purpose for imposing the 10 plagues of Egypt, but what was it? And what does he want us as his people in his church today to learn from the 10 plagues? When all is said and done, how should the 10 plagues spiritually enlighten and motivate us? And they certainly should motivate us. Anybody, who gets high-handed and upset about the trivial things, you go through the 10 plagues and suddenly you start to have a different sort of perspective. You watch the 10 plagues happen. What if you only had to go through, several of the plagues? That would sober you up pretty good, wouldn't it? Well, the Israelites got to do that. Now let's look at the 10 plagues of Egypt and ask why. What was God's purpose? What did he want those plagues to accomplish in addition to making the Egyptians let his people go? Let's turn back to Exodus. We'll spend a lot of time in Exodus in this sermon. Chapter 1. The plagues were a prelude to the Passover, the very first Passover, the original Passover, the institution of the Passover. This was the prelude, was going through these plagues. But this, look at a little of the background and the dynamics that had developed. We'll start right at the beginning of Exodus, verse 1 of chapter 1. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt, each man and his household with Jacob: Reuben and Simeon, Levi and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, getting them all down, and Asher. And all those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 people, because Joseph was already in Egypt. So this is the list of those who came in. Each of the heads of the tribes, they were the sons of Jacob, including Joseph, of course, was already there. From each of them would come a tribe, except for Joseph, and there would be two tribes. And the 12 tribes of Israel are actually the 13 tribes of Israel. And we say, well, how does that work? Because when they went into the promised land, there were only 12 tribes that inherited land. Well, that was easy. The tribe of Levi didn't get an inheritance. They were the priestly tribe. They had the job of providing the men who would be the priesthood of ancient Israel. They all had to be of the tribe of Levi. The priests all had to be descendants of Aaron, the brother of Moses. Nobody else had to be line descendants from Aaron. The rest of the tribe provided all of the support staff that would accompany the tabernacle, which was a portable temple that they used in the wilderness years and the wandering years, and later the temple itself. There was a huge support staff of Levites. They were just referred to as Levites. The priests were referred to as priests. So that was the calling of the tribe of Levi, that God gave it a special calling, and he didn't give it any land inheritance. The inheritance of Levi was the tithe of the 12 tribes. Then you think, well, okay, how were there 12 tribes? That's easy. Joseph was broken into two, Ephraim and Manasseh. Joseph had the birthright. A birthright son in those times, the one who had the birthright, typically the oldest, but not always the oldest, because Reuben was disqualified. He was the eldest. But it was Joseph, one of the youngest, who ended up with the birthright. Birthright meant, because you had to look after the patriarch in his old age, you got twice as much as the other brothers. And Joseph did. He had two tribes that were his inheritance, or his going to be his progeny. And that was the blessing that came on him and responsibility he had. In verse 7, we find out, though, getting back to Egypt, the children of Israel were fruitful, and they increased abundantly and multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. And notice what the Pharaoh at that time said. There arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, look, the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they boot us out of our own country, essentially is what the rest of his discussion was about. So they put them to slavery. Now, how they managed that, I'm not sure. If the Israelites outnumbered them, they got really careless because the Egyptians definitely got the drop on them. But I want you to think about a little bit of the significance of the nation of Israel that was developing there. They were settled initially in a land that you know of. There's a town in Indiana named it. In fact, there probably is one here in Ohio, and no doubt Michigan and Pennsylvania and a few other places. The land of Goshen. The land of Goshen wasn't just anywhere in Egypt. It was where livestock was raised, which was in the Nile Delta. The Nile River runs north, unlike most rivers in the world, except for all of Russia's rivers, which run into the Arctic Ocean and into the ice, the Nile River runs north into the Mediterranean. The delta is where the main body of the Nile breaks into several different rivers, or six or seven, not unlike how the Mississippi deltas out when it gets down past New Orleans there. And those various streams of the main Nile then feed into the Mediterranean. In the delta would be where you would have grasslands, where there was enough moisture that there would be a lot of grassland, which is what livestock need, which is what the Israelites excelled in. They raised livestock. The Egyptians didn't. They were more the dirt farmers. Oh, they worshiped livestock, but they didn't raise them. So the Israelites grew, and in being in the delta, there's another thing, and this is just a tidbit of history for you. They would have had access to the ports, because they were right there. At the edge of the Mediterranean is where the port cities would have been, which would then expect one to find Israelites involved in shipping to some degree at that time. Ancient history records that that was in fact the case, and particularly the tribe of Dan, which we already know from the book of Judges, that later on Dan would stay in its ships when Deborah and Barak needed them to come and fight the northern Canaanite kingdom. Why did Dan stay in ships, she says in Judges 5 in her song. And why is Asher at his inlets? They should have been here instead of sitting in their boats trying to protect themselves. We needed their help, and they didn't come. But it does tell us that at least two tribes then were sailing. History says that part of the tribe of Judah also sailed. The tribe, the element of the tribe of Judah that descended from Zerah. There were two sons, Perez and Zerah. Perez is the son through which King David its lineage goes. It was the royal line, the line that Christ would be born of, as prophesied. Zerah's line largely disappears during the Egyptian years because they aren't recorded to any significant degree. And some historians who have studied the tribes of Israel, the early movements, say that they sailed from Egypt and founded some cities in Greece and in Spain, which would account for early Celtic settlements there, long before the captivity of the rest of the tribes, much later, by the Assyrians. So here we have the Egyptians there, and the Israelites where they were in the Delta area. The Egyptians are feeling threatened. Pharaoh wants the death of all the Israelites' sons. He wants the midwives to immediately kill, either through strangulation or knifing, I don't know how they would do it, any son of the Israelites that's born. The midwives don't do it. They aren't going to do that. And they were greatly honored by God because of that. So then he reverts to the plan that then the movie picks up in the Ten Commandments movie. They'll be thrown into the Nile River. All the boy babies get thrown into the Nile River to drown. The girl babies can live. And you'll wonder, well, why would they want to let the girl babies live if they're killing off the boy babies? It's easy. They'll marry the Israelite women into Egyptian families, and they will subsume the Israelite culture into Egypt. There'll be no threat. But Moses' mother, who was, she and his father were both of the tribe of Levi, she had another thought, and she had two children already. She made the little ark, as it's called in the King James, a little boat of bulrushes, and then she paved it with asphalt. It sounds like it's paving with asphalt, but that means tar. She waterproofed the bottom of it so it would float, and then she threw it into the Nile. Except she threw it into the Nile in a very deliberate way. In fact, a very specific place, slightly upstream from where Pharaoh's daughter had her morning ablutions, when she'd go to bathe in the river. And sure enough, it floated right down to where she was with Miriam, Moses' oldest sister, following close beside it in the bulrushes. And she draws this baby out of the ark, calls him Moses, one drawn out. And then the little girl goes up and said, would you like me to go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse him? And she said, yes. And so she went and got Moses' mother, her own mother, and she nursed her own child, but she then turned him over to the Pharaoh's daughter, and she raised him. Now, the story of Moses is a little bit here, and it gets up to when he was 40 years old and has the incident with the taskmaster. But during his growing up years, he essentially was a prince of Egypt. Now, there was an animated movie made about this, which didn't have him old enough in the animation, or Pharaoh's son old enough to be accurate. But still, Moses was, in essence, a prince of Egypt, being the stepson of the daughter of Egypt. Other histories pick up where the Bible leaves off. It gives us what we really need to know. The others just add little bits of detail. Josephus, a great Jewish historian of the first century AD, says that Moses became a great general in the Egyptian army and then conquered the Ethiopians. Now, we know where Egypt is now, in the northeast corner of Africa. And the Nile River, you know, sometimes we think it only exists in Egypt. It actually doesn't. You go south into Sudan. The Nile goes down there. And down there you have two Niles that form one, the Blue Nile and the White Nile, coming down out of the high mountains of Abyssinia, which is the ancient name for Ethiopia. And then they form the main Nile, and it goes up through what is known as Egypt today. Egypt, even in the 1800s, included most of the Sudan. The last Islamic Mahdi, or that's the word for Messiah, was killed down at Khartoum in the River War led by General Kitchener in 1895, which was, incidentally, interestingly, the last time that the British Army had a massed cavalry charge against the enemy. 3,000 soldiers. And one of them, you know, Winston Churchill, was in the army then. He didn't fight with a sword because he had dislocated his shoulder playing polo or something in India. He fought with a handgun. So he put his sword away while everybody else is charging forward with their saber, and he just blasted his way into the Darvish, which were Islamic fighters that used big scimitar swords that they swung around above their heads like food processors or cavalry processors. And Churchill had a narrow escape. Anyway, diversion is over, back to where we are. That used to be Egypt. That was Sudan. So Ethiopia and Sudan and Egypt in the ancient world moved backwards and forwards. At times you had very dark African pharaohs, and that would be the pharaohs of the Upper Nile. And we think the upper is being north, but in this case it's south. And the Lower Nile pharaohs were more of the lighter skinned, a little bit more Arabic looking, maybe, Arabs. But that would be the Nile that's up closer to the Delta and the Mediterranean. That was the kind of pharaoh that Moses happened to be dealing with in this incident, but obviously had dealt with his competitors to the south. When he was 40 years old, he was back. He knew who his heritage was, just like the movie portrays, and he killed a taskmaster who was harassing a couple of Israelites. What he didn't expect, perhaps, was that the next day wanted posters with Moses' face on them were all over the land. And so he went on the lam, as they used to say in gangster days. I don't exactly know what they meant by lam, but he took off into the desert, the very direction that the Israelites were later to go. I don't think he swam the Red Sea. I think he went around the top end of it. But whatever the case, he was out on the Sinai. He went in far enough in to the Sinai that he came to the territory of Midian. And there he met Jethro, who was the Midianite priest, married his daughter Zipporah. And that's where Moses lived for 40 years as a sheep rancher with the Midianites. Now, his life slowed down from being a prince of Egypt and a great general commanding, you know, thousands of soldiers, to where he was in charge of a lot of sheep and maybe a couple other shepherds that he checked with from time to time. But mostly, he was in command of a lot of sheep out there. And then God called him. You know the story in chapter 3. Through the burning bush incident, and God called him and told him that he wanted to go and lead his people out of Egypt. And Moses was terrified of giving public speeches. You know, I was never any good at that, even though he had been, undoubtedly, because of the job that he had. And so he, God then said, well, okay, I'll send Aaron, your brother. He'll do the talking. You tell him what to say. You're in charge, and Aaron will be your mouthpiece. So that's how that comes. Finally, we move all the way back. With some continual persuasion, Moses had this sort of hesitancy about him that he didn't probably have when he was a younger man. God got him back to Egypt, and the hesitancy was going to be disappearing before long. So he gave Moses the game plan. This is what we're going to do. I'm going to free my people from Egypt. And this is how I'm going to do it. The game plan's in chapter 7, first 6 verses, or 7 verses of 7. So the Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you as God to Pharaoh. In other words, you know, you're going to give commands to Pharaoh. And Aaron, your brother, will be your prophet. And you shall speak what I command you, and Aaron, your brother, will tell Pharaoh and send the children of Israel out of his land, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart. It's a great plan, but I'm going to make sure it doesn't work right away. I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, but Pharaoh will not heed you, so that I may lay my hand on Egypt and bring my armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Eternal when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. Now Moses, goes on to say, was 80 years old at that time. Aaron was 83. So they went. They had the showdown with the magicians of Egypt. We know their names. We know the names of two of them, probably the two main ones. Janus and Jambres. If you hold your place there and turn back to 2 Timothy. Let me see, where do I have their names written down? Oh, there it is, yes. Now, 2 Timothy 3 talks about the last days, perilous times will come. And then we get down here a little bit further. In verse 9, ultimately we get to where we're going for. Lovers of money, in verse 5, and lovers having a form of godliness and denying its power, always learning, never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. In verse 7, verse 8. Verse 8 is our target. Now as Janus and Jambres resisted Moses, so do these individuals that Paul was talking about that were sometimes in the church or around the church, sometimes supposedly members and other times just sort of interested in the knowledge, are always learning, but never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Now, Jonas and Jambres resisted Moses. So do these resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds, disapproved concerning the faith, they will progress no further, for their folly will be manifest to all as theirs also was. Janus and Jambres were two of the Egyptian magicians, or magi, or medicine man, or whatever you want to call them, that resisted Moses. So we know two of the names of these chief priests that served the Pharaoh. And it is evident that they knew something of the truth. Potentially, Janus and Jambres were knowledgeable, possibly even had been Israelites themselves. One never knows on that aspect. So here we go back to Exodus chapter 7, and we know we're going to have 10 plagues that are going to be unleashed. And in the 10 plagues, God explains to Moses the process. He says the first one will be the Nile being turned to blood. So if you have 10 plagues, when you add them all up, you'll find that there are three sets of three. And at the beginning of each set of three plagues, and then you have the final big one at the end, which is the climax of it all, the death of the firstborn. But in the first plague and the fourth plague and the seventh plague, Moses has to confront Pharaoh personally. And he does it by the Nile River, because Pharaoh went down to the Nile River, just like his daughter had done, probably his sister more likely, when Moses was little. And he washes himself in the river. So Moses, in verse 14, God says, Pharaoh's heart is hard. So go to Pharaoh, verse 15, in the morning when he goes out to the water, and you stand by the river's edge. So the water is in the river. It's the Nile. It was a sacred river to them. They worshipped it. And you will stand by the river's bank and to meet him and carry the rod that you turned into a serpent. And you shall say to him, the Lord God of Hebrews says, sent me to you saying, let my people go that they may serve me in the wilderness. But until now you would not hear. But now I'm telling you that if you don't, we're going to turn the river into blood. So that was the first confrontation. And then if you go just a little bit further, the second one is in chapter 8 and verse 20. Where Moses faces off with Pharaoh at the river's edge early in the morning. And in verse 20, the Lord said to Moses, rise early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh as he comes out to water. And the water, again, would be the Nile. And then that's plague 4 and 5 and 6. And then the beginning of the next three plagues is going to be plague number 7. Plague number 7 we find in chapter 9 and verse 13. The Lord said to Moses, rise early in the morning, stand before Pharaoh and say to him, this is the Lord God of the Hebrews, and so on. But again, each time he goes to meet him in the morning, Pharaoh is going to the river to bathe himself in the water of the sacred river of the Nile. We have the game plan. We know what the confrontation is. Now we go to the plague number 1. This is in chapter 7 and verse 14. We read the part where he was to meet with Pharaoh. Thus says the Lord in verse 17, by this you shall know that I am the Eternal. I will strike the waters that are in the river with a rod in my hand, and they shall be turned to blood. And the fish that are in the river will die, and the river will stink, and the Egyptians will loathe to drink the water of the river. And Pharaoh brushed him off. Moses struck the river, it turned to blood. And it killed all the fish. And if it was, it says blood. A lot of commentators try to say it was red dust that blew into the river and made it turn red so it looked like blood. But that wouldn't necessarily kill the fish. But if it was blood, then it rotted too because of what blood is. It had to be a horrific stench. A horrific stench at the time. You got to stop and think about these things. I want you to smell the plagues a little bit and to hear the cries of anguish and anger and the thunder and so on as we kind of read through these so we can capture a sense of what the Egyptians were going through and maybe we can gather why God sent the plagues. Why didn't he just miraculously use a Jedi trick, a cheap Jedi trick, and say, let my people go. And Mother Pharaoh would say, oh, sure, go ahead. Y'all go. He didn't do that. God was teaching a lot of lessons to a lot of people. Moses, Pharaoh, all of Israel, and frankly, all of Egypt. Bear in mind, an awful lot of those Egyptians, all of those Egyptians, we will be dealing with in the Great White Throne Judgment. They got a day of salvation coming. They'll have their minds opened. And they're just typical of, however much of mankind has existed from the beginning. Now, here's another thing that God was doing. The Nile was sacred. And, in fact, the Nile had a god, had two gods. The first one is Hapi, or Happy, or Api, depending on if you pronounce the H, H-A-P-I. That was the spirit of the Nile, or the god of the Nile, one of the gods of the Nile. And then Khnum, I'm not sure if you pronounce the K and the H, but N-U-M, I'm sure you do. K-H-N-U-M, in English letters, Khnum, the guardian of the Nile, another god of the Nile. So when you struck the Nile water and turned it to blood and killed all its fish, all of the Nile perch, great big monstrous Nile perch that are quite tasty, and every other kind of fish that was in there, you were insulting the pagan gods. These were the gods that the magicians worshipped. And yet these gods were completely discredited by the plague. The Egyptian religion doesn't function. Now, they wouldn't think that to begin with, but they're going to find out. Let's go to chapter 8 and verse 15. Sorry, not chapter 8 and verse 15, chapter 8 and verse 1. Let my people go, and in verse 2, but if you refuse to let them go, in chapter 8, verse 2, I will smite your territory with frogs. Now, I've never seen a plague of frogs, but I have heard of them in some places, but they were plagues that might take over a lawn. This was a plague that took over a nation. Plagues of frogs, frogs everywhere. Basil Wolverton did some artwork in doing the story of man, the Bible story. If you go back and look at your issues of the original Bible story books years ago, and he had frogs scraped into heaps, and he showed the heaps. You know, he illustrated it, because that's what the Egyptians did when the frogs died. They had to pile them in great heaps. Can you imagine the smell of dead amphibians when they all were taken out, and the sliminess of everything that as they hopped all over the land and throughout your house, in your bed, and on top of you, and in your food, it was frogs everywhere. And you know what the Egyptians did in chapter 8 and verse 7? They produced more frogs. First, they had shown that they can turn water into blood too, probably by sleight of hand, and then they could produce more frogs. Oh, that's very helpful. Thank you. Their comeuppance is coming. Now, you think, well, what gods were discredited by that? The Egyptians worshipped the frogs. They were sacred to them. The frog god's name was Hekt, H-E-Q-T. So I presume that's pronounced Hekt. And they lived in the Nile, so it was an insult to our friend Happy, who we just met, who isn't so happy by this time at all. So two of the great gods, one of the Nile and one of the frog god himself, were completely insulted by the plague of frogs. And all that the magicians could do is make more frogs, which they weren't really making frogs. They were just throwing probably something gathered up on the way in, and they threw them down, and there they were. Plague number 3, chapter 8 and verse 16. This is the plague of lice. So the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, stretch out your rod and strike the dust of the land so that it may become lice throughout all the land of Egypt. And they did so. They struck the dust and it turned to lice, and it got all over the people and all over the livestock. The other rendering for the word that's translated lice is gnats, but they were as tiny biting flies, flying insects that could, and crawling insects that got all over the people. Some historians say they didn't have lice like we call lice here, but you know how lice are. They get in, they crawl all over through your hair, and you get head lice and you can't go to school, which happens even yet today sometimes. But that's the crawling kind of lice. These were, they all bite, whether they're the kind of lice we have or the lice which were more likely gnats, biting gnats, which are about the same size as lice, but they were thick everywhere. That wasn't fun, not by any means. So the Egyptian gods debunked. We don't have any evidence that they worshipped the lice or the gnats. However, notice verse 18 and 19 of chapter 8. The magicians worked with their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they could not. So there was lice on man and beast, and the magician said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. And Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them, just as the Lord had said. See, the only way that the magicians could show their power is that they would create more of whatever was causing the problem. Now, that's like, you know, I'm going to plague all your cars with brake failure. And then the magicians come, and they bring some cars, and then they cut the brake lines. See, we can do that too. They didn't think, hold it, What if we came up with a fix for the problem? That we could turn the water from blood back to water and revive the fish, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation or something? Probably not. But the Egyptians were, they were blocked at every turn. Now, there was no specific god that we know of that was a lice god, but this one would appear to be an attack on the power of the Egyptian magicians or priests. They couldn't create lice. So they were bankrupt as far as the arrows in their quiver of magic. That's plague number three. Now we come to plague number four. It's in verse 20 of chapter 8. The Lord said to Moses, get up early and stand before Pharaoh as he comes and down to the water, and tell him, let my people go, or I'm going to send you swarms of flies on you and your servants and your people and your houses. You'll be full of swarms of flies. And in that day, verse 22, I will set apart the land of Goshen in which my people dwell, that no swarms of flies are there. Oh, hold it. No swarms of flies on Goshen? What about the lice and the frogs and the blood in the river? Oh, yeah, they had to go through all that. It wasn't just that you weren't, it wasn't enough to be non-Egyptian. God let the Israelites suffer the first three plagues. The Goshen, the land of Goshen, where the river breaks into all the different channels as it goes through the land, it had to smell, if anything, worse than the main body of the Nile, because there's more surface area to produce the foul stench that would come from the blood that is decaying and the fish that are dying and rotting. It had to really stink. And they got the frogs. Thousands and millions of frogs all over the Israelites. And they had the gnats, or the lice, whichever it was, the same basic kind of critter. They were plagued with that, but they didn't get flies. You know how thankful you can be? Oh, wow. We only had gnats and frogs and blood to deal with. Flies. We didn't have to deal with the flies. It was such a relief. Why did God give the 10 plagues and three of them had to go on the Israelites? Well, we can surmise that. That would help them to appreciate the gravity of the situation, those first three plagues. You know, because they were reeling from it, I'm sure, and then they found out they're not going to get hit by the flies, and they breathed a great sigh of relief. They're thankful. And to make Israelites thankful, that's hard to do. Look at America. We're Israelites for the most part as a nation, but are we very thankful to God for what he's given us? Hardly. Only a few are. Well, these Israelites would have been thankful, I think, to not have any more plagues come their way, especially flies. So we have the flies. Verse 20, there were swarms of flies came all over the place, into the house of Pharaoh, in verse 24, into his servants' houses, and all of the land of Egypt, corrupted because of the swarms of flies. Flies lay eggs. Eggs hatch. And they can become maggots. In a few days, they're flies too. And they fly all over. And when you try to talk, they're flying in your mouth. And if you're being quiet, listening to somebody else talk, watching the flies fly in your mouth, they got trying to crawl up your nose or in your ears. And they're all over your hair. And they get down in your collar and up your pant leg, or, you know, they didn't have pants on. They probably wore robes, so they could go crawl right up your leg, buzz all around. It would drive somebody to distraction, you'd think. But the Egyptians got the plague of flies. And you think, oh, okay, well, that probably didn't bother any of the Egyptian gods. Oh, no. No, they had a fly god, too. Uatchet is his name. See if you can spell that. U-A-T-C-H-I-T. U-A-T-C-H-I-T, if you like to write down the names of pagan gods that were debunked by God himself. He manifested himself as a fly. The Egyptians had a fly god. And that's weird. Why would they worship a fly? Well, whatever the case, he wasn't much of a god, was he? Now we come to plague number five, the cattle disease, the livestock disease. This is in verse 1 of chapter 9. The hand of the Lord, in verse 3, will be on your cattle, on the out in the field, and on the horses, and on the donkeys, and the camels, and the oxen, and on the sheep. A very severe pestilence. But God will make a difference. Again, will make a difference between you and Israel. Israelites' cattle and livestock won't be bothered at all. And so they weren't. The Egyptian gods of the cattle, though, were completely discredited because they were supposed to protect the cattle of Egypt. Just like the Nile was to protect, supposed to be a god in water that protected them. The Egyptians, I think we all know, worshipped cattle. They had one named a sacred bull, Apis, A-P-I-S, and then they had some other sacred bulls and cows, Ptah, P-T-A-H, Minervis, spelled with lots of consonants, M-N-R-V-I-S, and Hathor, H-A-T-H-O-R. Those were the sacred bulls and cows. So their gods were not only not protecting them from their perspective as pagans, their gods had turned against them. I had to rock the boat of the Egyptians greatly. Now plague number 6. If that wasn't enough, now you're going to have boils and sores. Plague number 6. Take for yourselves a handful of ashes from a furnace and let Moses scatter it toward the heavens in the sight of Pharaoh, and it will become like fine dust in all the land of Egypt. This is chapter 9 and verse 9. And it will cause boils that break out in sores on man and beast throughout all the land of Egypt. And so they did that. And so it happened. Have you ever had a boil? It's an infection, a pocket of infection. And normally it'll swell up, and when it's drained, it's full of just pus, you know, yellow stuff. I had a carbuncle once. That is a boil that has sort of a head. I don't know exactly what the head's made of, but that's what they describe it as. And they definitely want to get that out, or it'll just cause the infection again. Well, this one had 5 heads in it. It was a large boil on my wrist. But it was nothing compared to the one on this cow we had. It was an Angus cow that had a little bit of milk cow strain in her, so her hip bones were prominent. And the boil that was raised up on her hip made her look like she had 2 hip bones. Well, we looked at that for a day or two, and it kept getting bigger, and we said, we better call the vet. We don't want to tackle that one ourselves. So the veterinarian came out, and we roped the cow, and then we roped her legs and pulled her down on her side so that she couldn't lash, you know, jump about while he was trying to take care of that. And he looked it over. He says, yep, that's a boil. And my brother and my cousin and I were right next to him. He was a friend of the family and wanted to see this thing. And he said, now, boys, you better walk over there by the fence, because when I lance this, it's going to fly. And we thought, well, we'll just go a little ways away. It can't be that bad. So he put the disinfectant on the spot, and he just took his surgical knife and stabbed it, and it shot a stream of yellow. It went sailing 15 feet into the air, and we ran and just barely got out from under it. That's what the Egyptian cattle, livestock would have been experiencing, and the people too, on a universal scale through the country. And the cow felt ever so much better. She was getting really listless. She got that much poison. That must have been a quart, I would guess, under intense pressure. That's a lot of poison to have in your system. And she recovered really rapidly after that was all cleared out. But they had all of their livestock, and the people almost universally had boils all over them. So which gods of Egypt were discredited? The religion of Egypt couldn't stop this. Sekhmet was discredited. She's rather the goddess of healing. And Serapis, S-E-R-A-P-I-S, is the healing god. He's the god of healing. Sekhmet, if you're wanting to write it down, S-E-K-H-M-E-T, S-E-K-H-M-E-T. They were useless. They had no power against the power of the true God. None at all. Plague number 7, hail. Now, if you think that's bad, you should have seen what happened next. I'll tell you about the hail that hit our cousin's farm in a moment. Then the Lord said to Moses in verse 13 of chapter 9, go in the morning, you go and stand before Pharaoh, and you say to him, let my people of... Thus says the Lord God of the Hebrews, let my people go that they may serve me. And so on, all these reasons why. But if you don't, then I will bring hail upon you like you've never seen before. And so that's exactly what God did. He'd bring hail, and then also you'll note in verse 24, the last part, there would be fire mingled with the hail. That would be lightning. Hail storms are typically lightning storms. We had hail every year on our farm in South Dakota. Sometimes it was minimal impact, and sometimes it was really bad. The year we were hailed out, we had wonderful corn. In those days, they talk about field corn being knee-high. On the 4th of July was a great crop of corn. Ours was shoulder-high on the 7th of July at 3 o'clock. We know the hour because at 4 o'clock it was knee-high. The hail came through, quarter to half dollar size hail, 50-mile-an-hour winds, and just cut our corn down like a scythe, where the stubs of the stalks were knee-high. You know, we were banking on, you know, the corn itself, the kernels, but all we could do was let grow what could still grow and chop it for corn silage without any corn in it to feed our cattle in the wintertime. And my father and uncle were partners in this farming operation. And the next year, 7th of July again, except the storm hit at 4 o'clock instead of 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And it did exactly the same thing. And that put the partnership out of business, to have two crop failures in a row like that. You know, that was minuscule, because when our cousin came, my father's cousin came to visit, and you're the one that said, if you think that was bad, you should have seen what happened next. Well, he went through all the things that had gone wrong, and, you know, cattle dying from sickness and this, that, and the other thing, and then the hail came. We lost a lot of our chickens because they were free-range chickens. They just ran around, and when you got hailstones coming down that big, it kills chickens, it kills pheasants, any kind of bird, unless they can get under cover. Now, a lot of our birds did get under cover, but a lot of them died as well. In his case, his chickens had stayed in the chicken coop. He didn't have them free-ranging that day. And it came, the hail killed them too, because it came through the roof of the chicken coop and killed the chickens. And it killed some of his cattle. He showed us a photograph of the hailstones. He had a half bushel basket. You know what a half bushel is, about yay big, with 9 hailstones in it, and it was full. That was a deadly storm. And it had to be a phenomenal, I know how hail's made. You have a high level of air that's got moisture in it, and the droplets come down through its warm moisture. They hit a freezing level of air in the middle of the winter or summertime. There'll be a freezing level up there high enough, and they freeze into little ice balls, tiny ones. And then where there's an updraft, they get pushed back up into the moisture again. They take on another layer of moisture, come down and freeze, and they're bigger. And that goes that yo-yoing back and forth and back and forth until they get to whatever size they're going to be. We had between half dollar in diameter to quarter diameter hail coming down at high winds. And it was the reason we did it. We were in a hail belt. We had cliffs that were at the edge of the farm, and the cliffs create an updraft. And when the conditions are right, that's what keeps throwing those hailstones back into the moist air to collect more moisture and come down and get frozen and get bigger and bigger and bigger till the updraft can't hold them, and then they just come down with a vengeance. So for him to get hailstones like softballs or so was incredible. And yeah, like you said, if you think that was bad, you should have seen what happened next. Yeah, he was out of business, you know. He had to sell his farm. That was it. There wasn't much left to sell, in fact. House was wrecked. Chicken coops were wrecked. Barns were ruined. And most of the livestock was killed. Now, magnify what he went through. And his was mild compared to what the Egyptians went through. They had devastating hail. It killed people and livestock that were in the field. And only the ones that would listen to what Moses had said, they, in verse 20 of chapter 9, who feared the word of the Lord among the servants of Pharaoh, made his servants and his livestock flee to the houses. They were protected wherever they had a substantial enough structure, but not if they were out in the crops. And you think, well, which gods got it this time? Seth, S-E-T-H. Seth was the god that protects the crops. Didn't do too well. And Nut, although I think she was pronounced Newt, N-U-T, the sky goddess. Those two gods, or a god and a goddess, of the Egyptians, again, completely discredited. Plague number 8, locusts. Locusts are like grasshoppers, only bigger. We had lots of grasshoppers where we grew up. We didn't have real plagues of them. In the 1930s, they did, in Nebraska, where my father and my uncle had grown up, and in a lot of other places, that was contributed to by the Dust Bowl at that time, that they had plagues of grasshoppers. But they're essentially a type of locust. It is what a grasshopper is. But there was a neighbor farmer of theirs who raised turkeys, and he would hatch out 500 or 600 turkeys in the spring. And then with the mother hens and such, he would herd them through the cornfields and the bean fields of all the neighbor farmers. They didn't eat any of the beans and the corn. They only ate the grasshoppers. And so he just would make arrangements to, I'll bring my turkey through your corn tomorrow if that's all right. Oh, sure. Please do. Hey, clean out the grasshoppers, slick as a whistle. At the end of the year, he had the fattest turkeys you ever saw. And he had no investment in it. He didn't have to buy the food. What a deal. No, the Egyptians didn't think of that, but then again, they wouldn't have survived the hail, so there you go. What gods were discredited by the locust plague? Isis, the goddess of life, is locusts are a part of life. And again, Seth, the god of crops, protector of the crops. Now we come to the thick darkness. This will be in chapter 10. Well, the locusts are in chapter 10 as well. The thick darkness. The Lord said to Moses in verse 21, stretch out your hand to heaven that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, darkness which can even be felt. And he stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was thick darkness on the land of Egypt for 3 days. But there was no darkness in Goshen. And there were no locusts in Goshen, except probably the ones that floated down on the Nile and got eaten by the fish that were resuscitating back down in the Delta. The thick darkness was like the gloom of oppression. Let's turn briefly to this. It's in Isaiah. Hold your place, if you would, in Exodus. But I want you to read a prophecy that leads to a very famous prophecy about the coming of Jesus Christ. It's in Isaiah chapter 6. Here we are. It's Isaiah chapter 9, starting in verse 1. Nevertheless, the gloom will not be upon her who is distressed, as when at first he lightly esteemed the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. And where was the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali? They bordered the Sea of Galilee, both of them did. So it was up in the northern end. They were part of the northern 10 tribes, and they were up at the northern end of that. Zebulun and Naphtali. And afterwards, more heavily oppressed her by way of the sea, beyond the Jordan, in the Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness, they were oppressed, they were in darkness, and the plague of darkness is an oppression. But they have seen a great light, in verse 2, those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined. And shining a light, a brightness of light, is symbolic of freedom and opportunity. And here's the reason why, when you skip over 3 and 4 and 5, you get to verse 6. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. And the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. It's a prophecy of Christ and his second coming. And the incredible time in the millennium. Well, the thick darkness is brought out in the imagery there is oppression. And the Egyptians had oppressed themselves. God wasn't oppressing them. They had oppressed themselves. This was the fruit of their pagan religion, was darkness, spiritual darkness. So we're back in chapter 10 of Exodus. The Lord said to Moses in verse 21, "Stretch your hand out to heaven that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, darkness which may even be felt." And thick darkness was in there 3 days. The gods of the Egyptians who were discredited by that was Re, the sun god, spelled R-E, not R-A-Y, and Atum, or Atum, A-T-U-M, the god of the setting sun. Thick darkness is an insult to the gods of the sun. And the Egyptians didn't have one sun god, they had two. Very, very interesting. Plague number 10. Now we come to the big one. This is the death of the firstborn. Notice in chapter 12, first several verses, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, said, "This month shall be a beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you." So we have here the institution, formally, of what we call the Hebrew calendar, and rightly so. It uses the Passover season is the beginning of, in the first month, Passover being on the middle of it. "And on the 10th of this month, every man will take for himself a lamb, according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household." And in verse 5, "And your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. Take it from the sheep or from the goats." So it could be a goat, a kid, instead of a lamb. "Now you shall keep it until the 14th day, and then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight," at the end of the 14th day. Or at the beginning of the 14th day, I'm sorry. "They'll kill it at twilight, and then they will take it indoors, and they will consume the lamb." Now, in order to avoid the plague, the 10th plague, they must paint the blood of the lamb on their lintel and on their doorposts of the entryway into their homes. Wherever their Israelites gathered to observe the Passover, the sign of that lamb's blood painted on the doorposts had to be there. So the first three plagues, the Israelites shared with the Egyptians. They got them just as bad as the Egyptians did. The rest of the plagues, the other six, they didn't. And then the final one was conditional. "You obey my command to mark your house in such and such a way, or the death angel will come in and kill your firstborn." Now, for the Egyptians, it was a devastating plague. For Pharaoh, it was a devastating plague. "At midnight," in verse 29, "the Lord struck all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. So Pharaoh rose in the night, and all his servants and all the Egyptians. There was a great cry in Egypt. There was not a house where there was not one dead, and there might have been more. Because a mother and a father and the firstborn child, maybe they had a number of children, but that firstborn dies. But what if the mother or the father or both of the mother and the father were firstborn in their families of origin? They died. They were firstborn. So you may have had multiple deaths in a household. And then your livestock, whatever was firstborn. The cavalry is galloping with a message to Pharaoh, and then one of the horses goes down pitching its rider, as it was the first foal of its mare, its mother. Now, the death of the firstborn was devastating to the Egyptians. Israel was exempted from the plague, as I said, conditionally. They had to obey God in marking the homes where the Passover was being kept. What Egyptian gods were insulted or degraded or discredited? Osiris. Osiris was the god of life, the giver of life. And Pharaoh himself, because they worshipped Pharaoh. And they said, why would they do that? Well, we had people in the 60s that worshipped rock stars. It's not that much of a stretch. That's idolatry too, you know. But Rome worshipped the Caesars. They considered them to be deities, which they probably borrowed from the Egyptians. Pharaoh could rationalize all the other plagues, but he couldn't rationalize the death of his own son. And I think the Ten Commandments as a movie did a fairly good job in capturing the sense of that. Which tells you something about Pharaoh, though. Pharaoh was not a firstborn because he didn't die in the plague. So that's kind of an interesting tidbit that you can figure out. But let's get back to our conclusion now. Why the 10 plagues? I mean, we looked at them. It's devastating. It's horrendous. It's tragic on a vast scale. Why the 10 plagues? What was God teaching Israel? What was God teaching Egypt? He certainly was discrediting the pagan gods. I think one lesson, and I'll let you mull this over, and maybe you'll see other lessons as well that you can draw from it, lessons that you can learn from it personally, perhaps, as we come up on the holy days and the Passover and everything. But I think one of the greatest lessons is simply this. God is God. Remember, it's in 1 Kings chapter 18, if memory serves, it's verses 38 and 39. It does have it written down. The time when Elijah challenged the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel during the drought in Ahab's day. And the prophets of Baal brought their bull, and they stacked their wood, and they cut up the bull and put him on the wood, and then they cried to Baal to call fire down from heaven and burn it up. Well, they kept going and going and going and going, and they started cutting themselves. That was one of their techniques. A pagan technique is cutting to make Baal feel sorry for him, I guess, and burn up their bull. Then Elijah sat there and taunted them the rest of the day until it was about the time of the evening sacrifice bound at the temple in Jerusalem. And then he got a few helpers and he said, okay, slaughter the bull, cut it in pieces, stack the wood, put the pieces of the bull up on top of the wood, and then dig a trench all the way around it, and then go and get water from that stream over there where there's still a little water, and pour barrel after barrel after barrel after barrel on top of the whole sacrifice. Everything was soaked wet. And then the trench with the ditches were all filled with water. And then Elijah stood up and he prayed. And if you read it, time yourself and do it with feeling, it takes about 12 seconds. And all of us, he prayed for God to accept the sacrifice and with fire. And God sent a ball of fire out of the sky and whoo, smoked the whole thing and dried all the water out of the ditches that were around it. And then being in a weakened state as they were, the prophets of Baal were easy targets for execution. But the bottom line is the Israelites, when this all happened, and the ball of fire came down, they started chanting something. God is God, or the Lord is God. Essentially, they were saying, God is God. The Baals are not God. Baals were pagan gods. And the gods of Egypt were all pagan gods. Only the true God is God. That's the huge lesson we learn here. Only the true God is God. Salvation only comes from the true God of the Bible. It doesn't come from any other religion. Even though there are many sincere people that followed them. I mean, the Egyptians, I'm sure they were sincere too. Some of them anyway. But no salvation comes there. There is no pagan salvation. No false religion salvation at all. And likewise, today there's no salvation in any other religion except God's truth. And the 10 plagues make that statement profoundly. And I think we need to meditate and consider that very deeply as we come up to the Passover this year. The Church of God corresponds to the Congregation of Israel, as we covered the typology lesson in the Bible study last night. And that it was the congregation in the wilderness. That's what the Israelites were then. God's church is the congregation of God today, his church today. That was a type. They were physical. We have the benefit of spiritual conversion. We understand God's truth. We know the true way of salvation. And there is no other way. Only God is God. I believe that's the greatest lesson we can draw from the 10 plagues.